morning. Certainly in my 28 years of life, the USS Cole attack in Ada Gibbon on October 12th was a defining moment. And certainly those subsequent 3 weeks of fighting damage and hoping to get home are part of that. But in recent conversations around the fifth anniversary that happened about 2 weeks ago, a lot of people have asked me, how strong are the emotions approaching that fifth year of the anniversary? And some people at work ask, how do you go to work on a day like that with something that monumentous? And really my answer, truthfully, was that particular day didn't hold a particularly strong emotion for one reason. And I can honestly say I think in the last 5 years there has not been a single day between October 12th of 2000 and today, October 23rd of 2005, where some part of that didn't come to my remembrance. There was not some part of that attack that I didn't meditate on or think about seriously or even mourn some of the aspects of that. So I think it kind of took away some of the hurt of the actual fifth year anniversary. I certainly don't bring this to your attention so that you feel sorry for me, but I think just about everybody out there who's my age and older, or maybe a few younger, have had an event in their life that has that same captivation of their thoughts, that throughout their life they've gone back to it over and over again, they've learned a lot of lessons from it, and they've dwelt on it. And those of you who are younger than me and may not have had something similar yet, I feel pretty confident in stating that throughout your life you are going to face a trial of that magnitude, a trial of that consequence, and while it will certainly probably be different in its nature, it will captivate your mind like it has for me with USS Cole. I have three goals for sharing this with you today about what happened in Aden. First of all, to those of you who are Christians and have been similarly tried, I hope these observations are an encouragement to you and allow you to renew your praise and thanksgiving for God's deliverance. And secondly, also to those of you who are Christians, I hope these thoughts will help all of us to prepare for those days ahead, which may not be as normal and mundane as we had this morning as we got up on, again, October 23rd of 2005. And lastly, to those of you who do not profess Christ, I hope you will hear in my testimony that passing through this trial with God by my side was a blessing, but also that passing through this trial without God was a disastrous and crushing blow to many. A Cole-like event in the life of a man or woman without Christ who is separate from Christ can be devastating, and in fact it has led to suicide, broken homes, chemical dependency of various sorts, depression, anxiety, and mental sickness in some. While God's common grace gave many the ability to avoid these traps following our return to the United States, God's saving grace gives us confidence that we can go through these trials and obstacles without it damaging us for life. At this point, I think to set the tone, to give you an idea of what happened, I'm going to transition to recounting the actual events of October 12th. And hopefully, we'll spend no more than 20 or 25 minutes so we can move on to the meat of what I've prepared. I did hand out one through Mr. Harris, one map that kind of shows the harbor itself, and I hope that that's helpful. I'm used to giving this recounting of events with a PowerPoint presentation that shows pictures, and I can explain things to those who are not used to Navy terminology a little bit quicker. But I trust that that will give you some aid in being able to look at where we were, how things happened and unfolded. Very quickly, my background as far as the United States Navy is I reported to the USS Cole after training and graduation from the Virginia Military Institute in December of 1999. I started on board the ship in the engineering department. I was what they call the auxiliaries officer. I was basically in charge of everything that was not main propulsion, that didn't drive the shaft in the engineering rooms. We had somewhat of a leadership problem in deck division. I was moved 3 months after we got to, I reported to the Cole. I was moved to deck division. And deck division is the largest division on the ship. It's comprised of recent high school graduates, recent high school dropouts, those the judge sent into the Navy, many who have not declared what their specialty is going to be. They're young. They're still looking at what they're going to do with their lives in the Navy. They're put into deck division, typically a lot of 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old young men and women without any specialized training. It is the largest division. My responsibility was to manage these people. My responsibility was also for the exterior of the ship and any sort of operations that went on outside the ship, whether it be flight quarters, landing helicopters, underway replenishment, which is put alongside a supply ship and putting oil and food on board the ship, so on. Any type of exterior operations was typically my responsibility. So on August 8, 2000, I had been on the board the ship less than a year. We were getting ready to deploy. We had done all the workups to deploy, and we left on August 8th. We were part of the George Washington Battle Group, the George Washington being a U.S. naval carrier, and typically all the destroyers and cruisers are kind of centered around the carrier as far as operations are concerned. We transited the Atlantic Ocean, passed through the Strait of Gibraltar, and we spent 1 month in the Mediterranean Sea doing everything the recruiter ever promised. We went to places like Barcelona and Valletta, Malta, to Slovenia, various other places throughout the Mediterranean. It was basically port visits and training between port visits. It was a very memorable and enjoyable time of seeing that part of the world. About a month into it, we transitioned to more real-time operations at that point. If you remember back to that time in 2000, there was the re-election attempt of Milosevic in the former Republic of Yugoslavia. There was a lot of concern that he would have an undue influence on the elections, that his serious way of dealing with his own people would influence their judgment in the elections, and that he would win more from coercion than from actual democracy. We were put off the coast of Yugoslavia as a show of presence, basically to show the United States flag and an attempt to basically influence him and his people maybe to back off a little bit on those election attempts. The election did occur. He did not win, and you probably are familiar that he's basically still going before tribunals. His name still pops up every once in a while. But after that election was complete, we were detached from the battle group that was in the Adriatic Sea there, and we were sent south. We were supposed to be in the Persian Gulf at this point, and we were told to make best speed down to the Suez Canal to arrange a Suez Canal transit the Red Sea and around the Arabian Peninsula and into the Arabian Gulf or Persian Gulf, as it was more commonly referred to then. Along that transit, we were realized we were not going to have enough fuel to enter the Persian Gulf with little less than a quarter tank, which some of you might have come this morning on a quarter tank, but on a Navy ship, that's way too low to have any sort of flexibility in your maneuvering. So we were told to find fuel, and the closest and best route for that was to go through Aden, Yemen. A lot of people, including myself, after the attack, asked the question, why in the world are we going to Aden, Yemen? That kind of sounds like the Wild West hundreds of years ago. And there are some legitimate, maybe not correct answers to that, but there are some answers. And very quickly, this port is one of the largest seaports on that Med to Persian Gulf route. It is a great natural harbor. It's large. It has a tremendous amount of fuel capacity and the infrastructure to get it to the ships. Djibouti, which is right across the Arabian Gulf, is a French-owned area, and their port services were dilapidated. They really had a difficult time protecting you. So in 1998, the Navy switched from using Djibouti as a refueling port to Aden, Yemen. We had had some friendship with Aden in recent years. We had helped them develop a Coast Guard. We kind of helped them clean up after their 10-year-long civil war. And all that's to say, in 1998, we signed a contract. We weren't the first contract to be signed. The UK, Italy, and France had also been going in and out of the port. Throughout that time, their port capabilities were increasing. They're putting a lot of modern money in there. A lot of this was probably predicated also on our political ties and trying to aid them in their cleaning up of their town, essentially. Also in Aden, though, at this time, we had a terrorist presence that was known, and there was kind of a legal organizations that were allowed that essentially could look them up in the phone book, as it were. Those two organizations were Hamas and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, which I'm sure you've both heard of. And then the unwelcome presence, and again, kind of quotes, because there hadn't been a whole lot to do that had been done to express their unwelcomeness in the country, was, of course, Al-Qaeda. As we approached Aden on the morning of the 12th, one thing, going stepping back real quick, we were the 25th ship in the United States Navy to go into this port. So there had been quite a bit of habit, some things had developed so that people could kind of see patterns. As we approached Aden, I had been on the 2-7 watch that morning as a junior officer at deck. So I was pretty familiar with how our transit was shaping up and what the area looked like. And as we approached the quay wall, I was turning over my watch to the officer of deck who would have been taking over and doing the actual transit into the harbor. And just to kind of set the tone, and I usually have some pictures here, but the harbor itself, it looks very dilapidated. There's ships that are laying on their side. If it basically wasn't in the channel, it was just left there. It kind of gives you an aura of this place is not really under the rule of law, that it's just out there and no one really cares for it at all. It's certainly a lot different than what you'd see pulling into United States port. If you look at your maps that I handed out, you can see the harbor's kind of split into two pieces. If you look on the left-hand side, that's more of the commercial, the fishing, the small vessels. And the right-hand side is where you have your deep water channel. That's where all the merchant vessels, the large merchant deep draft vessels would go, and any sort of Navy vessel. We pulled in there and met that first buoy that you see on there, kind of on the bottom side of the page. It's about 7:44. And at that point, you pick up a naval harbor pilot. And that's not, for those of you who hear the word pilot, that's not anybody to do with aircraft. That is strictly someone with the local knowledge of sandbars and things that you might not be able to see on a normal chart. We picked him up, and there was a couple things that made him a little bit suspicious, especially looking back on it. He had been very aggravated at our speed of transit. He wanted to hurry up and get there for some reason. He was very anxious to get off the ship when we got there, and he has since disappeared. So there really not a whole lot of conjecture that he was involved with the attack, but more than likely had been told, you need to get it there by such and such a time, and you certainly need to get off by such and such a time. We were brought alongside a fueling dolphin. You can see out in the middle of the picture there, there's a blue arrow with a mooring station that points to the dolphin itself. This was not a pier. We were not connected to land in any way. We were kind of isolated there in the middle of the harbor. Small boats assist you taking lines out to buoys and to the pier itself or to the dolphin itself, and you tie up there in the middle of the harbor. We were on the south side of that. As you're looking at it, there were certainly plenty of areas for surveillance. You can see to the land to the south of there is about 522 feet in elevation, so there were certainly many areas that you could look out over it and see what was going on. At 8:51 local time, which would have been 7 hours advanced from here, we moored and our lines were tied up. During this whole process, I would have been topside or up on the top deck of the ship, involved with handing the lines, making sure everything was tied up securely. Because we had been underway for about 45 days, there was a lot of garbage built up, and one of the key things that we were going to do in this port, other than get fuel, was offload garbage and trash that had just been accumulating. About 9:20, that garbage barge came alongside. We moved it back aft, so you had a lot of activity around the ship, a lot of small boats moving that barge. We were beginning to pump fuel at about this time and bringing the fuel on at a pretty rapid rate. At 10:30, the attacking boat launched. If you look at your map again, there's a neighborhood off to the extreme left of your page called Al-Barik. It is a kind of a slum-like neighborhood over near where a lot of the fishing marinas are. They went to a place and paid off a young boy to watch their truck and their trailer, and they went down into the water, not through an actual marina, but just a graded area down to the water. They began that transit across the harbor at about 10:30. At 10:55, we removed some of the trash barges, took them off, replaced some. So again, you have activity around the ship, a lot of small boats, harbor boats were moving around the ship. As this boat approached, to give you a brief description of it, if anybody saw the History Channel presentation recently, the pictures they used were very good at defining what this boat was like. It was about a 32-foot long fiberglass boat that had outboard motors. It was not a little dinghy. It was not inflatable. This was a rather large vessel, again, 32 feet long, and obviously could displace enough water to hold a lot of explosives. It approached our midships area. There was some visual communication between one of our lookouts. They acted as if they're approaching the others with the garbage barge because they had just been moving off. There was a brief exchange of kind of pleasantries. The guys both stood up and saluted as they came up alongside the ship and did not really give, at that point, you could kind of see in the lookout's eyes that something was going wrong, but really gave them no time at all to respond. At 11:18 local time, 4:18 Louisville time, the attack actually occurred. At the time of the attack, I had been back in the aftmost portion of the ship in the back. I had basically just had a brief to-do list meeting type with my sailors and was just kind of giving them the plan of the next couple days. I had finished that. I was headed up to my stateroom. I was going to write a quick email to my wife and then go to lunch. 11:15 is when lunch started on the ship that day. I had transited up the port, the left-hand side, which is the side of the attack. I ran across Ensign Triplett, who was a fairly close friend of mine, who had helped me when I reported to the ship and had briefly roomed with him. We talked very quickly. He was headed down into the oil lab where he was monitoring the oil flow coming on board. He was responsible for main propulsion, and so I had kind of worked with him my first 3 months there. And so he was headed down. I distinctly remember to this day asking him if there was anything I could help him with. He said no. He was going to run down there for a brief moment, and then he was going to meet us up there in the wardroom for lunch. At this point, I took a few more steps forward, went up one staircase towards the wardroom, and that was when 1118 occurred. Ensign Triplett went to the oil lab and was killed immediately by the attack. The damage itself, and this again is where pictures come into play, and if you wanted to see these some other day during the week, please let me know. I can provide you with some of this. But it created basically a 40 by 40 foot hole in the ship that you could have driven any vehicle in your parking lot through, any truck through. Is a massive hole that you only saw maybe one-fifth of above the waterline in the pictures that you're probably familiar with. Destroyed two of our four main engine rooms. It destroyed all of our supply spaces from the lowest level where parts are kept to the next level where the refrigeration and freezer storage is, and then on the actual deck where we have our mess decks, the eating area, that was destroyed and actually where many of the casualties happened. The exterior of the ship was pretty well destroyed just anywhere. Basically, there wasn't a support behind the steel. It was bent in. The quarter deck area itself, that midships area, was all ruffled. The center P-way that actually runs a thwart ship across the ship was damaged about two-thirds of the way across, so you're looking at about 45 feet into a 66-foot-wide ship was pretty well destroyed. So one thing I normally point out, if in God's providence this had been a frigate or a different class of destroyer, it probably would have literally cut it into two pieces because they're about 20 feet less wide than we are. Many of the people that were killed were actually in the chow line itself, but thankfully the starboard side really is where more of those people would have been exposed. But many of those people were killed while they were waiting for lunch or picking up lunch or getting drinks. All the way the extent of this damage is really amazing. It goes from the top of the ship to the forward part of the ship to the very aftmost part of the ship. And really, most importantly, 17 people were killed, 39 were injured. It really was a devastating blow on a crew of 275 people. That's a pretty healthy portion of the crew who was taken out. Many of those were chiefs, which are your senior enlisted, who really hold the resident knowledge of how all the systems work and how it plays together as far as fighting damage. The initial call for help went out via a cell phone. All of our communications gear was taken down, and that call for help went on a cell phone that was given to us by a defense attaché about an hour and a half after he saw the attack from land. He had been out shopping on his lunch break, basically. He was able to catch a small boat out there, and that was a whole different story how that exchange went as another boat starts approaching us. Thankfully, there was a uniformed personnel in there, so we could kind of make that happen. He gave us a cell phone, and we made it a call into 5th Fleet. At this point on, to give you some idea of the living conditions, we had no food, essentially, other than some snacks out of vending machines in our ship store. We had very little water. It was very hot. There was no electricity on board the ship, so there was no ventilation inside the ship. It was pretty well as filthy a living condition as you could imagine. As those days progressed, the smell of rotting food, and to be frank, the smell of rotting corpses was pretty pungent. And to me, the most intense memory for me is the smell, and if you ever come across a smell like that, it to me brings back more memories than anything else, is just the intense smell of the ship in those weeks following. And from this point on, really our primary focus was damage control. My responsibility in battle stations is a repair to locker officer. And basically what that means is I had one-third of the ship assigned to me, from which I had this locker which had all kinds of damage control equipment for pipe patching, for stopping flooding, for shoring up a bulkhead that was failing. And under the direction of the captain, of course, you're directing the flow of equipment, the people, and everything to and from damaged spaces. So really my focus was not on saving personnel, it was on saving the ship itself. The average age of those killed was 23 8/10 of a year, so basically 24 years old. The age span was from 19 years old to 35 years old. Two of these people who currently worked for me were killed, six of whom had previously worked for me before they had come into their specialty, their rating, and so all eight people who had worked for me were killed. As this goes on, and I'm already running out of time of kind of the events part and what I've allocated for that, but the damage control effort was really, to me, an amazing effort. I encourage you, you know, the media has kind of misrepresented a lot what's happened, but that History Channel presentation recently does give a flavor of how difficult this process was. On Sunday morning at about 2 a.m., the ship began to sink again after we had initially stabilized it to some extent. We were having a tremendous amount of flooding, and this is kind of one of the highlights of the story of how we saved the ship, but we were not able to get power to any pumps. We couldn't pump out the engine room. We lost a third engine room. The ship had been determined that it would crack in half, that the keel would break, and we'd sink. It was imperative that we save this space that night. One of the young men at HT1 Regal, hull technician, first class Regal, came up with the idea that if we go down there with a torch and cut a hole in the side of the ship, that we could get just a regular vacuum pump to suck this water out. And mind you, he'd have been standing in 4 or 5 feet of fuel and water, of oil, and we all went down there and basically watched him did it. And to me, it was probably the most intense part of that entire 3 weeks, as we sat there watching sparks fly into the oil and just praying that this thing would not explode into a gigantic fireball. And of course, God in His mercy protected us from that, and we got that hole cut, and that's how we drained that engine room. And I can assure you there's no damage control manual in the entire United States Navy that says when you're flooding, cut a hole in the ship just above the waterline and drain it that way. So it was a pretty amazing story, and there's one after another. There's great acts of courage that I personally witnessed with people who were injured, looking after people who were injured more than them, people who went into spaces that were about 2 feet from being completely flooded, and saving someone who had a nearly severed leg. I could go on and on, if time permitted, with acts of courage, with acts of great intelligence and ingenuity. It really was an amazing thing to witness. Quickly, though, on the 14th, which is Saturday, Allied ships arrived, so things started to progress a little bit. We were starting to get some aid in both supplies and food at this point. Water was coming from the embassy. Things were looking a little bit more hopeful. Marines arrived to help protect us. FBI, Navy workers, Navy shipyard workers, and divers arrived to help us recover bodies. And then the 3 week period after is just one trial after another of trying to get this ship ready to be moved, of trying to save the ship itself, of trying to preserve it intact as much as we could and be able to shore up around the hole so that we could actually get this thing to sea. One thing I will mention is the captain was very adamant from the time we recovered the 17th body, and that was about exactly 1 week after the attack, that we were from that point on to look at nothing more than saving the ship. We had a memorial service, and from that point on, we really were to put the things of mourning and stuff behind us. And I think that was a wise call because it really focused people on what our effort was in saving the ship. On the 29th, we were towed out. There's a kind of a unique story of how those arrangements were made because it involved me going into aid in itself. Again, really just not enough time to go into that, but we got the tugs we needed. They towed us out to the open ocean. The United States Navy sent us an ocean-going tug who towed us out to the Blue Marlin, which is a Norwegian contracted ship that typically moves oil rigs. We had this ship ballast down. We moved over the top of it. It ballasted up in one of the most amazing engineering feats I've ever seen. It came up underneath us perfectly and raised us up and got us out of the water and began a 55-day transit around the Horn of Africa since they did not want to risk going through the Suez Canal. At that point, we took a boat to the USS Tarawa, and from the Tarawa, we took a helicopter to the nation of Oman, which is also on the Arabian Peninsula. From Oman, we took a chartered jet to Germany, spent a night just kind of decompressed before coming home, and flew from Germany to Norfolk and reunited with family and friends. The one thing, there's just been so much that you've seen in the media about, you know, whose fault. We've seen the captain kind of be singled out. There's just so much going on. I think the one thing that I've always pointed out, And of course, I've usually gone into much more detail on this, but Vice Admiral Moore, who is the commanding officer of Fifth Fleet, the entire Middle East region, there's a quote by him I think is pretty powerful in answering any of those questions that might be in your mind. No matter what these inquiries conclude, it is clear that the heart and soul of the Navy is our people. If nothing else, the attack establishes that the men and women who wear the Navy uniform are the best in the world. USS Cole was gravely wounded, and like generations of sailors before them, they rose to the challenge and saved their ship. And I know that's what I like to tell the most about, is how those young men and women did that, and I certainly got to see it. At this point, though, I know that's kind of a very brief overview of the account. Hopefully that gives you some picture of what happened that day. If you have other questions, please feel free to ask. I'm more than willing to share much more with you. But having looked at those accounts, I want to transition now to deal with five observations that I found reaffirming in my own mind as I looked at those events. And I also want to give you four preparations that you might need to weather a storm like the attack on the Cole. And if time permits, and I don't think it's going to, I was going to give six observations on what a Christian leader does in a situation like that. Psalm 18 is a powerful psalm that David expresses his gratitude for after his numerous deliverances in his life. And the first time we see this psalm is in 2 Samuel 22, and in both the first verse of that chapter and in the prelude to Psalm 18, we read this: David spoke to the Lord the words of this song on the day when the Lord had delivered him from the hand of all his enemies and from the hand of Saul. So obviously, as you read through David's life, he had many instances Cole-like in some ways. He had fought Goliath. He had fought in the chapter previous in 2 Samuel 21, numerous Philistine giants, and he had prevailed. He had been delivered by God. And many of the sentiments that he expresses in Psalm 18 are things that I felt well up in my own heart then, now, and in the years in between. So I'm going to kind of put these five observations in some of David's language. And the first observation I'd like to bring to you is that God is a shield to those who trust in him. I'm sure you all can picture what a shield looks like, but a shield is a broad piece of armor carried on the arm as a defense against blows from a sword, lance, or arrow. It's a piece of equipment that protects the one who is being attacked from various parts of the attack. If you were to look out on an ancient battlefield, you might see a soldier out there wielding a sword in one hand and a shield in the other. And because of that shield, he's allowed to knock down the blows of another sword, and he's allowed to use his sword for aggressive and offensive purposes. And if you looked out on that same battlefield, you may have seen another soldier who neglected to bring his shield. And he's going to be using that sword as nothing more as a defensive weapon to try to glance off blows of another person's sword. So a shield is obviously a very important piece of that warrior's gear. That unprotected man, that unshielded man would be on his heels, often backing down in the fight, and would be primarily interested in using his offensive weapon as a defensive weapon. In Psalm 18, David uses the picture of a shield several times, and you'll need to turn to these. I'm going to be kind of reading through them quickly. In verse 2, it says, "The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God, my strength in whom I will trust, my shield and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold." And in verse 30, "As for God, his way is perfect. The Lord is proven. He is a shield to all who trust in him." And finally, in verse 35, "You have given me the shield of your salvation. Your right hand has held me up." The attack on the coal and the ensuing aftermath is not a fight I would want to have entered into without the same shield that David sings of thousands of years earlier. True courage is rooted in our salvation, as we can have confidence that the end game, the actual state of the soul, is already secured, that that's not up for grabs in that fight. This does not mean that a man or woman is courageous is without fear. I certainly had fear in my heart as we went into this, but rather it means they'll do their duty in the face of fear. And in my experience, this was played out personally. As the bomb detonated, thoughts began to race through my mind. I first thought, hey, we were rammed by another ship. And then some reason it came to me that we were rammed by an airplane. I really don't know why that went into my head. Then I began to realize that we were listing, leaning. So I really began to think, well, maybe we're actually sinking as this was happening. And then I kind of realized as the smell of gunpowder or that kind of explosive came through, I realized we had been attacked. And immediately then your mind runs to secondary attacks. Will we get home? Will I see my wife again? How will this all end? As these thoughts ran through my mind, I was doing everything that I could to get to my battle station. So it didn't actually stop me from doing any part of my job. My duty at that point was to get to my repair locker and contribute to saving the ship. I would never claim that I did not think of losing my life in that time. I remember distinctly it running through my mind, well, this may be the way it all ends. But in fact, in minutes, if not seconds, I can't give you the exact timeline. I remember stopping up against the helm of the bridge. It's where the actual steering wheel, if you were, of the ship is, and saying a brief prayer. I have no idea how long, but there are three things I remember asking. I remember asking that God would save my life. I remember asking that he would save our ship. And I remember asking that he would be with my wife as she heard the news. While I think any normal person would have had initial mental wrestlings with the waves of fear, I do feel that God's shield of salvation quickly gave me confidence to do my job aggressively and without reservation. Times would actually get more precarious in the following days, and yet, after that initial wave of fear, I really felt settled in my mind that God had determined to preserve me through the end of this ordeal, and I can assure you that peace was not of my own doing. I would challenge those of you who are in the fray right now without that shield of salvation to stop and think what you are doing. While you go on from one normal day to the next, it seems like you can saunter through life without salvation, but at some point you will come under fire. You are going to be tested, and you're going to be challenged to your breaking point. And when those days come, whether it's tomorrow or tonight or 30 years from now, I would say to you that you need to have that shield of salvation. And it has been freely offered to you in the gospel, and this church has certainly made it plain to you, and it's been faithfully preached, how you can pick up that shield and carry it with you from this day forward. The second observation I felt I made in my own mind was that God strengthens them who trust in Him. And we know that salvation will change our dead hearts to living hearts. But David also expresses in the psalm that God gave him actual physical strength in the battle. In verse 1, we read, "I will love you, O Lord, my strength." Verse 2, "My God, my strength, in whom I trust." In verse 32 to verses 34, we read, "It is God who arms me with strength and makes my way perfect. He makes my feet like the deer and sets me on high places. He teaches my hands to make war so that my arms can bend a bow of bronze." And lastly, for you have armed me with strength for battle. You have subdued under me those who rose up against me. David is telling us that in addition to the mental toughness and courage that salvation provided, God also supplied him with actual physical strength, speed, even mentions agility like a deer, and the skill to make war. And left to our own, even great training and preparation will not preserve our strength through extended times of difficult trial. And throughout those 3 weeks in Aden, the heat was intense, the stress was great, the days were very long, circumstances were uncertain, the work was very physical, what we were doing, and the rest was very broken. There was not extended periods of rest. Despite that, I personally felt sustained throughout the period that we were there. And God truly was giving the majority of our crew the rest and the strength they needed beyond any normal measure to get through that high level of activity that was extended over those 3 weeks. And it is an exhilarating feeling, I can assure you, to know that the actual creator of the universe will measure out strength as needed for those who know Him. We are given the strength needed to overcome these difficulties that are set in our path. And I think many often think of this strength just in the context of our mental or emotional state, but I think it also applies to our physical strength. It was not David's emotions or mind that bent that bow of bronze referred to or subdued those who made war against him. Rather, it was the physical strength given to him by God that was the actual means God used to protect David and allowed him to wield those weapons and kill skilled warriors in hand-to-hand combat and overtake his enemies in pursuit. Thirdly, God hides a smiling face behind frowning providences. Everyone in this room, I'm sure, could at least heard Romans 8:28, or maybe can even recite it. We know in our hearts that God is working for our best, but so often when providence frowns on us, we lose that faith and we throw up our hands thinking all is lost. We fail to see through the circumstances that the blessings of God are even in our most serious trials. David, I'm sure you're familiar, had many dark providences in his life. And those certainly were on his mind as he read, or as he penned verses 7 through 12. In Psalm 18, verses 7 to 12, it says, "Then the earth shook and trembled. The foundations of the hills also quaked and were shaken. Because he was angry, smoke went up from his nostrils and devoured, and devouring fire from his mouth. Coals were kindled in it. He bowed the heavens also and came down with darkness under his feet. He rode upon a cherub and flew. He flew upon the wings of the wind. He made darkness his secret place. His canopy around him was dark waters and thick clouds of the skies. From brightness before him, his thick clouds passed with hailstones of coal and fire." We go on a couple verses later to read that God sent from above. "He took me. He drew me out of many waters. He delivered me from my strong enemy." And as I was trying to think how to describe what David must have been feeling, I think the words of Matthew Henry really sum it up the best. He says in a short quote, "His glory is invisible, his counsels are unsearchable, his proceedings unaccountable. And so, as to us, clouds and darkness are round about him. We know not the way he takes, even when he is coming towards us in mercy." And I think that's the key there. Sometimes we don't even realize when he's coming towards us in mercy. "When his designs are secret, they are kind. For though he hides himself, he is the God of Israel, the Savior. From the brightness before him, his thick clouds pass, comfort returns. The face of affairs is changed, and that which was gloomy and threatening becomes serene and pleasant." There's no doubt in my mind that October 12th may have been one of the darkest days in my life and the other 275 there. In an instant, 17 shipmates were killed, 39 were maimed, wives were lost, children were lost their fathers and mothers, you lost fellow citizens and patriots. A lot of people's lives were changed. In addition to the human toll, a $1 billion U.S. warship, which is really sovereign land, was destroyed. And really, also, if you look at the history of it, the war that led up to 9/11 was begun on 10/12. Yet despite these horrors, behind the dark clouds was the brightness of a gracious God. And God was merciful in a variety of ways. And I want to show you a couple specific ways. It would take too much time to detail every shining face that was behind this dark providence, but here are a few. Our ship was only supposed to have one corpsman. There's supposed to be one Navy chief that is the corpsman for the ship. Before we deployed, we were assigned a command master chief, and his role is not necessarily to do a specific job on the ship, but to be a go-between between the enlisted and the officers, between the enlisted and the commanding officer. It just so happened in God's providence that this man who was chosen was previously a chief, a Navy corpsman on board other ships. So essentially we had two 20-plus year experienced Navy corpsmen on the ship when we were just supposed to have one. And that in and of itself saved lives, I can assure you. Another area, if you remember, we were refueling. There was fuel everywhere. I mean, we were drenched in it. We smelled like it. You could see it everywhere you looked on the ship. And yet not one single fire came out of that attack. Now, there were some indications there was a fire in the engine rooms, but those were flooded almost immediately. And it really, to me, is amazing that we hold 450,000 gallons of fuel. That's a lot of fuel. And for us not to have a single fire on board that ship is nothing more than God suppressing the fire, in my mind, and keeping the ship from being destroyed. Lunch began only 3 minutes before the attack. If it had begun 15 to 20 or 30 minutes before, I think we'd have had many more lives lost. In addition, there was actually a lot of people who were napping through lunch because we'd just done an 18-hour transit through the Suez Canal, and that was through the night when everybody on the ship has to be awake and at their station. So you had a lot of very tired folk at this point who just didn't go to lunch. Another kind providence was that in the aftermath of this attack and us fighting the damage through shattered steel, jagged steel, the fuel, the electricity that had been exposed, the wires and so on and so forth, not a single life was lost after the instant of the attack. We went through 3 weeks in pretty devastating living conditions. No one got sick beyond just normal sicknesses and stuff associated with that type of living. No one got killed. No one lost a limb. No one got electrocuted. It was really amazing to see what we were living through and not to have a single person hurt. The chaplain, who I have a very high regard for, is a true man of God, had been on our ship quite a bit. He had transferred off of it just a couple days before, which really was a blessing in and of itself. Every lunch period, he served chow in the chow line to enlisted sailors, exactly where the people who were killed would have been. He, no doubt, if he had been on our ship, would have been killed that day. He was able to get a ride back to our ship on that Saturday, and in my opinion, was a very faithful servant in those 3 weeks. And one of the reasons I had asked to sing hymn 629, which is, as you may be aware, is the Navy hymn, is that for me, there is no hymn that has the emotional attachment that that one does, which was some risk in singing it. But we sang that on Sunday the 15th. The chaplain had gotten there Saturday night, and we had a short chapel service on the flight deck. The only time I've been in that sort of environment where we had machine gun nests on both sides of the rows. And we sang that hymn first off before we prayed together and had a very short and brief time of reading the Bible. So it really was a great providence that he wasn't killed and that he got to come back to the ship. And very well, there could have been souls impacted just from the fact that God had removed him from the ship days prior to that attack. Another personal providence was that Hannah, who was on fall break from school, arrived at our apartment in Virginia Beach the night before the attack. I think for both Hannah and Stefan, that was a great relief to have each other to lean on throughout that day of 14 to 16 hours, somewhere in that, of not knowing the status of anyone, and even in the days following, just knowing that I was alive, not whether I had been injured or anything else. So it was certainly a mercy that Hannah had arrived and that they could spend the day together. And lastly, and of course, it's one of the strongest in my mind, is I came very close to death in that situation as far as just the timing. When I look back, it could have, for one, I mean, the most obvious thing to me is if Andrew had looked at me and said, "Yeah, why don't you come down? I could use a hand." I would, no doubt, would have followed him right down into that space. And why he didn't, I've done it before. I'd gone down there with him before in previous days to watch that whole process. And at some points, I was trying to learn how the process worked, but I'd gone down there other times, too. It's very strange to think about, and certainly a blessing at the same time, and then sometimes just grieving just how the providences did work in his death. But the list could go on. The point was that God was good to us despite this incident. He did not leave us in this time of trial. There were bright spots for us to focus on. The problem is, in our own lives, we do forget this. As Matthew Henry said, we become so confused by the events, we don't even see that God's coming towards us in mercy. The fourth observation is that God hears the prayers of his people. In Pastor Jim's preaching through Nehemiah, we've certainly seen a great example of somebody who knows how to pray, and I trust that this has affected all of our lives, but certainly David had similar confidences that Nehemiah had. In verse 6, he says, "In my distress, I called upon the Lord, and he cried out to my God. He heard my voice from his temple, and my cry came before him, even to his ears." When the attack occurred, there was this sense of helplessness that I try to explain to you. You know, who would I cry out to? Would I cry out to my family, my wife, my father? They were 5,000 miles away. I had no way to call them. Certainly, that was a pretty vain effort. Would I cry out to the government? Well, they haven't responded 5 years later, so I don't think they would have responded that day. Would I cry out to the commanding officer? He had bigger concerns, and rightfully so. He was worried about the overall picture of the ship, and my personal anxiety was not his concern, nor should it have been. There was only one place for me to go, and that was to our Savior and our God. I could pray to God, and I knew he would have confidence that even from an isolated third world country like Aden, he could hear my prayers. The same God that David prayed to in his distress, the same God that my wife could pray to in Norfolk, Virginia, I could also cry out to for help and courage. As I mentioned previously, when I reached the bridge of the ship, when I was trying to find basically air and figure out how to get from my place to my battle station, I distinctly remember praying and pausing on the bridge. And I feel that minute spent in prayer was what got me into the right state of mind to go back down into the ship and do my duty as far as fighting the damage. One other thing I want to briefly mention as far as prayer is this didn't impact me, I don't think, till I got home. But when I got home and got a stack of probably this many emails when it was printed off and when I got to read letters, it really was a powerful thing to realize the numbers of people who are praying. I knew when I was there in my mind, I'm sure people have started to hear the news, I'm sure there's prayer being sent on our behalf, but it really was overwhelming to come home and actually see the extent of that, and it's just an amazing thing to be part of a bond of brethren that will do, that will take out their time of day and that they will pray on your behalf. I guess the question I have for those who do not believe in God is, where do you turn in a time like this? We read later in Psalm 18 that those who hated David, that were stated enemies of God and Israel, that they were put under David's foot, as it were. Their lives were going to end by David. And we see that David had been given the necks of his enemies. And in verse 41, we read what they did in response. They cried out, but there was none to save, even to the Lord, but he did not answer them. These people were stated enemies of God, and they had never looked to God for salvation. At this time of personal endangerment, they began to look for help for self-preservation, not for spiritual salvation, but just for preservation. And in that situation, their prayers went completely unanswered. I just trust that you will not find yourself in that situation. The fifth observation is it is good to give thanks. We often forget the repeated deliverances in our lives. It's very easy to forget them. When we're removed from the situation, our mind starts running to our current situation, not what we were delivered from. But David certainly had not forgotten what God had done for him. In verse 49, near the end of the chapter, we read, "Therefore I will give thanks to you, O Lord, among the Gentiles, and sing praise to your name." It has been my conscious thought that I will never forget that feeling that I felt when the day I stepped on the boat to be transferred to the Tarawa, then on to the Blue Marlin, from the Blue Marlin to the Tarawa, then on to the airport. It was a great feeling of warmth and thankfulness in my own heart, the fact that we were headed home. It was really the first time in my life where what we might call the necessities of life were not granted to me, where you had to fight for food and water, where the heat was so oppressive you felt like you just couldn't stand it any longer, where you're in living conditions where it made you and your digestive tract and everything else physically sick. It was really the first time in my life, VMI included, where I had an actual lack of physical necessities. And to be able to go home and realize that we have those so readily available to us was very much a rebuke to me. And as a Christian, it is really our duty to be distinctive in this area. We might think that if your life had been in danger and that God had preserved us from a danger like I just described to you in the cold, that you would be thankful. Well, if I had been in your situation, I can never forget to be thankful. But I think the principle that he was faithful in little is faithful in much would indicate that someone who fails to give thanks for the small things in life is not going to give thanks for a great preservation either. So I would certainly encourage you to be thankful for those small things in your life so that if your life is preserved, that you will have a spirit of gratitude. At this point, I want to quickly transition to four preparations for the battle, I'm calling it. I think there were four areas in my life that I felt had been prepared primarily through the means of God using godly parents in my life to direct me in these ways. I'm certainly not taking credit for them, but I trust that it will allow especially the young people in this area to prepare for an event, a life-altering event like we faced. And the first one is taken out of Ecclesiastes, another well-known verse, Ecclesiastes 12:1. Remember now the Creator in the days of your youth before the difficult days come. Briefly, this verse I think is given for two reasons. First, we cannot presume upon the number of our days, so we have a duty to call on the Savior from our youngest years. That duty is not put off till later in life. But secondly, I think maybe more when you look at the context of this, that we're supposed to remember our Creator in our youth, so it could have the sanctifying influence of avoiding those sins and temptations and foolishness, particularly tempting to young people. All the dead on the coal were young. Like I said, it went from age 19 to 35, and I think that probably encompasses more than half of those in here. Some were as young as 19. As the dawn of October 12th broke that morning, I certainly was not thinking on my mortality. In many ways, I was probably presuming on life that day. I have no recollection of even crossing my mind that day. And I'm guessing most of those other 17 had a similar situation. And those 17 people were killed in peacetime, so-called peacetime. They were killed on a ship that they were protected by 5/8-inch steel surrounded completely around them. They were protected even though they had 275 of the most well-trained sailors on board. They weren't protected even though they were on the most advanced warship in world history, not just at this point. There was 90 Tomahawks. There was every kind of weapon system you can imagine. There could not, in my mind, be many safer places on this earth than on a destroyer, unless you're really more on the open ocean and, you know, in a World War II type situation. I'm guaranteeing it's probably safer than many places in Louisville. But in James 4:13 to 17, we read, and this really puts it into context, whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. But now you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Therefore, to him who knows how to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin. The single greatest thing you can do to prepare for the unexpected is to find safety today in Christ. The problem is you are not guaranteed another day, and yet many of you feel you can deal with your spiritual issues tomorrow. And that is a very foolish bet, a bet you might lose, and a bet that has eternal consequences penned upon it. I think young men especially are prone to have this attitude of invincibility. And if you live with that attitude, I would challenge you to come talk to me this afternoon about how that shredded steel did not discriminate against man or woman, against young or old, against those who could bench press 300 pounds or those who couldn't lift their body weight. It didn't matter who you were, it would kill you. The fact is that a 21-year-old strapping young man is just as much a vapor as an 85-year-old frail woman. In the overall eternity, they're exactly the same. Both only have one way to eternal life, and that is through the cross. The second area of preparation is to prepare and learn for your job in your life to the best of your abilities. Two verses in Proverbs, nearly identical. I'll read Proverbs 22:29. Do you see a man who excels in his work? He will stand before kings. He will not stand before unknown men. And it was certainly encouraging to me that day to see that young officers, young sailors, people who didn't have a whole lot of experience, myself only having about a year on board by the time the attack happened, they were able to contribute to the effort of saving the ship, and they were respected for it. Nothing would have been more difficult for me to leave that ship knowing that I could not have contributed in some part to the effort of saving that ship. Our commanding officer had personally pushed myself and other young officers to qualify early. So the Navy gives you basically 18 months after reporting to your ship to qualify as a surface warfare officer. He pushed us very strongly to qualify before that, and in fact, I had qualified the month of the attack. He wanted us to be able to be a major player in the upcoming deployment, and that certainly paid off in a mighty way when the coal was attacked. Those of us who had been on the ship a year could actually contribute as a member of the team. And that was a good feeling. That still is an encouragement to me. And we should be that man or woman who excels in his work to the extent of our God-given abilities so we can be a contributing member of the church, of your workplace, of your school, of your family, and so on. Quickly, third, develop a strong work ethic. And there's so many verses in Proverbs I could read. Hopefully you're convinced that laziness is sinful and hard work is a virtue. So I won't go into that now. If you're convinced of that, if you aren't convinced of that, go back and listen to the recordings from the work conference we did back in August, and I think you could be much more convinced. The fact is that on the coal, there were some who didn't put forth the effort, I think, that was demanded of them, but the fact is that those who had a good work ethic, despite the heat, despite the stress, they were able to shoulder the load. And I would say every Christian has a duty to be one of those who shoulders the load, not one of those who sits underneath the tent and looks to get out of the sun. Make discipline in your life a priority is the number four, the fourth preparation. And in Timothy, There's a paragraph in there that talks about how bodily exercise profits a little and godliness is profitable for all things. And certainly we understand that that verse is correct, that bodily profit is little and godly discipline is certainly great gain. But the fact is, bodily profit is of some importance. It's little when compared to spiritual discipline, but it is of some importance. And I think those habits you develop as a young person with even bodily discipline will carry into your spiritual life when you become a Christian. It'll help you discipline yourself in your own Bible reading and your prayer life. And certainly as we, the crew of the Cole, sailed that ocean leading up to the attack, it was discipline that was already ingrained in our minds through training, through different preparations that we had gone through that allowed the crew not to panic at the attack, to step forward and do their job. And discipline, I think, saved that ship. An undisciplined crew would never have done what that crew accomplished. Now, finally, on this little section, there's one major caution I think you need to understand. That those things I just mentioned are not developed once you're in the battle. They might be refined, and I hope in my life they were refined to some extent. I learned more about discipline, more about hard work, more about remembering my God, but they certainly aren't created in those times more often than not. God might use it, but in the normal course, you have to have it today so that when you get into that situation, it can be refined at that point. Very quickly, in a couple of minutes, I just want to briefly highlight, in my own mind, I've always thought that a Christian leader is one of the most useful things that you can find, whether it's a leader in the church, whether it's a leader in the workplace, and military leaders. I think there cannot be a better leader in the military than a Christian man. So there were things that I observed in those weeks, and I had in my notes here kind of applied it to the life of Joshua or taken examples out of Joshua's life to highlight it. And I'll just briefly read them. A Christian leader is first a good subordinate and servant, and I certainly saw this in how the officers go up through the ranks in the Navy, but even in Joshua's life, we see how he subordinated himself so faithfully to Moses. Second observation, a Christian leader never forgets accountability to his superiors, and you certainly see that in the military structure, and a good officer, you'll see, is accountable to his superiors, is accountable to his people. And in Joshua's case, when we saw the captain of the army, when God came to earth himself and came before him, and when Joshua confronted him of, you are for us or against us, and he found out who he was, we see that Joshua, too, is accountable to his superiors, and he immediately worshiped God in that instance. A Christian leader takes responsibility for his own actions, for his subordinates' actions, and for the overall effect of the enterprise. I saw the captain of our ship step up, and basically he understood that the outcome of this event was his problem or his success. And many people looked at it more of his failure, but I think truly in my mind it was his success in leading us through that time. And you see the same in the life of Joshua after the Battle of Ai, where he took accountability for that situation. He went to God in prayer and laid himself out before God saying, you know, how have I failed? How have we failed? And he was the one, I think, who was the tool God used for repentance. The Christian leader achieves the goal of the organization, not his individual goals. Again, if you'd have had somebody in that situation who was looking for individual goals that had been only one thing on his mind, how do I get credit for saving this life? How can I do something in the sight of others? What can I do to come back with an award at the United States when we get to the United States? And Joshua, similarly, when we read his departing address, there's really only one thing on his mind, and that's despite beating 31 kings, he led Israel to the promised land. He accomplished great things in his life. Yet we read in his parting address, you have seen all that your Lord has done to all these nations because of you. For the Lord your God is he who has fought for you. And he doesn't even bring up his military leadership, which certainly was a tool that God used to make that happen. Fifthly, a Christian leader knows when to put himself on the front lines. I saw repeatedly, and hopefully it played out in my own life, where you as a leader, you have to go down into that space. You have to go stand in the floodwaters. You got to stand by the side of those who are doing things that are more dangerous than yourself as an officer. And I certainly learned a lot about that, I think, in those 3 weeks. Joshua seemed to have picked up that lesson in his life when they ascended from Gilgal. He and all the people of war went with him and all the mighty men of valor. After we read a verse or two about God telling them their directions, we see that Joshua led them and came upon them suddenly, having marched all night from Gilgal. He was the one who got in with those troops and marched all night long. He was the one who led them down. And I certainly think that success as a leader under fire legitimizes that leadership to some extent. And lastly, a Christian leader is used by God, and I think that's the most important thing to remember about leadership, is that God does use those things. And where I took that out of Joshua's life was that in Judges 2, 7 to 10, without reading it all, we basically read about how Joshua died and that the leaders that had served with him continued on. And during all the days of those leaders in Joshua's life,
Israel served God. And when those predecessors had died off, when nothing, no remnant was left of Joshua's leadership, we see the nation fell into sin. So certainly we, I think, can deduct from that that God used the actual godly leadership of Joshua to be very useful in that nation's life. And hopefully, if you become a Christian leader or are a Christian leader, he will use it in yours. Well, I apologize that it was so quick as far as the recounting of events. I'm sure that leaves many questions in your own minds. If you do have questions, I'm more than willing to answer them for you today or at a later date. And I trust this has been useful for you. Let's pray. Our Father, we do come before you today thanking you for your marvelous providences in our lives and especially for leading many of us to search out your Son on his cross and the way you brought us to you. We do pray that more might become ready for the future by doing that even today, that they might pick up that shield, that they might defend themselves against the enemy through the strength that you provide in salvation. We do pray that this Lord's Day would be a blessed day. We do pray for those men and women who are out there today in harm's way. And we ask more than anything that this Sabbath day might be a day that you might bring their souls to you so that they might truly be prepared for the battle that lays in front of them this week and in the years ahead. We do pray these things in your name. Amen.